Alrighty, start my little clock. How are we all? Bloody good. End of the day. Who went partying last night? Oh, very few people. So, welcome to The Architect as Economist. I promise there will be no visual studio today. Trying something a little bit different. All about sort of decision making and thinking around sort of costs and incentives. As we work as architects and software developers. So let's get started. A pretty important concept is the weighted average cost of capital. So this is essential in determining the discounted cash flow based net present value of any project. I mean, pretty simply, weighted average cost of capital is the market value for equity over your market value for debt plus your equity times the expected return on equity plus the market value for debt over your market value for your debt plus the market value for equity. Times the cost of your debt, times 1 minus the corporate tax code. Who knows their weighted average cost of capital? Bloody good. So I'm just bullshitting you, right? I was going to see if I could get someone to leave with that slide. But actually, it's a really important thing to at least have in the back of your mind. If you don't know what the hell weighted average cost of capital matters, right? Cost of capital is how much do I like having cash in my pocket, right? Because when we think about things like cloud computing, how much I like having cash in my pocket really matters, right? Who likes having cash in their pocket, right? So, big companies and small companies, which sort of companies most like having cash in their pocket? Who's got the higher weighted average cost of capital? Small companies, right? Now, we can obviously work it out from my bloody great equation, or we can kind of work it out intuitively. And so what sort of companies might really like OPEX over CAPEX? Small companies, right? Small companies love the cloud. Doing a startup, love the cloud, right? Because I want to keep that cash in my pocket, spend it on something else. So economics is really the art and science of common sense. Unfortunately, quite a lot of people lack common sense. But, you know, it's not about bloody numbers and maths and all that sort of bullshit, right? It's basically all about how we make decisions, right? Economics is all about decision-making. Did anyone study economics? Yeah, a few people? Yeah, so I wish I'd done a bit more economics, but I kind of got into it, you know, after I left university. So it's all about what are the trade-offs we make, right? When we're at the supermarket and we're looking, which brand of veggie might, or, you know, spread am I going to buy today? We're sort of doing trade, you know, we've got a trade-off going on there. Am I going to waste time dicking around trying to find the cheapest one? What's the opportunity cost of my time? Who thinks they're really good at taking full account of their opportunity cost when they go searching for deals? Well, I'm really bad at searching for deals, right, because I don't take account of my opportunity cost. So, you know, we don't always have this common sense. And I actually think that bringing some of these ideas, you know, looking at how we build software systems and bringing these ideas of, you know, what are the incentives that are driving my decision-making as I design this thing are actually really, really important. So prices really, really matter. And I think one of the biggest things we're seeing with the cloud is really a move from the unseen to the seen in terms of prices. So, you know, previously, a lot of the prices that we work with, a lot of the costs that we work with have basically been unseen. You know, we go and buy a whole lot of hardware and it kind of just, you know, sort of buried. We couldn't really quantify exactly what that's costing us in increments. You know, we do a whole lot of work to build this application, but actually we haven't really measured, you know, what is the value of that work in terms of the value I'm going to get out or in terms of the savings I'm going to get out the other side. With the cloud, we get this sort of nice bill on our credit card each month and we can actually see, you know, directly what are the decisions that we're making, doing, in terms of changing those. And also, you know, one of the things that's really happening in this very, very dynamic economy is that markets are becoming extremely efficient. When people find mispricings, they take advantage of them. Who's heard of Airbnb? Cool. Who's heard of, like, Lyft and Uber? Lots of people, all right? These are all basically either pricing or regulatory arbitrage plays. Who's heard of monkey parking? Couple have heard of them. I'm going to tell the monkey parking story. So monkey parking is a price arbitrage play. All right? It's a cool little app. You put it on your phone and you're driving around San Francisco and you park your car and you say, park my car here. Cool. Now, if someone else is driving around San Francisco looking for a car park, right, they'll say, how much would you pay to find a car parking spot? There's not a lot of car parking spots in San Francisco. And they might say, actually, I'll pay $10. Cool. So we'll then text you, because we know where your car's parked, and say, you know, so-and-so is going to happy to pay $10 if you can help them find a park. Well, can you help them find a park? Well, you kind of can, because when you go back to your car, you can say, yep, I'll just sit in my car until Maggie in the silver Chevy Silverado comes up, and then I'll pull out and she can pull in. Cool. So now Maggie's paid the $10. She's taken my car park. She's still got to pay the parking meter. All right, Maggie's happy. All right, who's not happy here? Who's not happy? The city of San Francisco aren't very happy, right? Why? Well, are they happy or not? Because, you know, they could have had that. They could have had that money, but they didn't. Right? There was a mispricing, and someone's arbitraged them. Right? What can we say about the price of parking in San Francisco for this to be able to happen? It's too cheap, right? And when stuff's too cheap, right, when we're not using price as a rationing mechanism, what are we using as a rationing mechanism? Queuing. Great. And we're going to talk a bit about queuing later, right? What are the people from Oakland doing now? Who knows where Oakland is? Cross the bay, right? Getting in their bloody cars, driving to downtown San Francisco and cruising for parks, right? This is an arbitrage play. The modern economy, right, there's a whole lot of innovation going on that's basically pure arbitrage, right? You know, there was a really crazy business called Aereo in the States that installed millions of tiny little DVB-T terrestrial MPEG-4 receiver chips in a big warehouse in New York to receive free-to-air television and stream it across to your device to try and have a bit of an arbitrage play with the folks who sell cable TV services for a much higher price than the free-to-air broadcast of exactly the same content. They got whacked by the Supreme Court. This is a really innovative area. And so this, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff you think about here. You know, allocation. How do we fairly allocate these scarce parking resources? If not by price, then we're going to allocate it some other way. Right? And if we don't do it by price these days, some crazy bloody startup's going to jump in the middle and argue, right? You know, what are the incentives? Suddenly there's this great incentive, right, for the, you know, the hobo from bloody Oakland to get an old dunger and come and cruise around downtown San Francisco. That's not really a good thing. Right? Opportunity costs. This is all about people's opportunity costs, right? The only reason you're paying for this car park is you can't be asked sitting around trying to find one. Queuing and substitution. You know, so what does this do in terms of driving incentives to substitute driving for, say, public transport? There's no free lunch, right? You know, we think that we can, cater to, you know, make parking available to everybody so that they can all afford it. Well, actually, you can't do that. Right? If you've got a scarce resource, you've got to come up with some other way to do it, right? Otherwise, you know, the cost, there's a cost incident somewhere. That cost lands on somebody. And it's ultimately a fixed assets problem, right? We've only got so many car parks, we have this peak load, and we just run out of them. Really hard to deal. But these are all problems that we start to see, or we have seen for some time in IT. So, we had the tragedy of the commons at Intergen. Where are my Intergen folks? This one, it's Damien, yeah. Some here, Damien here? We've got about a 1,500 machine private cloud that basically runs our dev test environment. That's quite a few machines. Quite big scale, quite hard to look after. And it always ran at absolute 100% capacity. And if you needed a machine, you kind of scrounged around and did a bit of horse trading with someone to try and get them to turn something off to free it up. Why do you think that might have been? No cost, right? There was no cost. Do you want a machine? Yeah, sure, you can have a machine. Right? There's no bloody cost. What incentive is there to turn it off? None, right? So we had a hell of a bloody time. So what we did is we put some monitoring on the... everything sort of runs through these firewalls. These environments stand up and connect through a virtual firewall. So we put some monitoring on the firewalls and basically said, okay, if it's not any traffic through it for 7 days, we'll turn it off. And we got about 15% of our capacity back. So that was really good. So then we thought, okay, we really need to think about costs here, right? Because costs provide signals and drive incentives. And I wanted to drive some incentives into the people using my private cloud to say, hey, actually, you need to use that private cloud a bit better and, you know, be sensible about when stuff gets turned off, because I don't want to have to go and buy a whole load more hardware. But unfortunately, at Intergen, our managing director's an accountant. And he says to me, you know, there's no, over my dead body, we're doing business with ourselves. Because I'm like, yeah, we'll just do some internal cost accounting, it'll be fantastic. He said, no. And I'm like, well, maybe we just make it about costs, all right? How about this? Every morning when the project managers come in, they just have a whack with the stun gun for every machine they're in. Right? I'm a technologist, hey, man, that sounds like a great way to apply some costs. Yeah, they weren't so keen on that either. Right? And in fact, the problem with just doing it on a cost basis is that there's no substitution. Right? It's not like they can say, oh, I really, really need this machine, but you know, if you're going to whack me, I could go and do something else. You know, they can't really apply the penalty, the payment of the stun gun, right? They can't go and apply it somewhere else. So what we really need is we need prices, right? Because prices allow us to balance these competing goods, right? We can go and have a look at, you know, what else could I do with what I'm spending on the private cloud to go and do it with the public cloud and things like that, right? So the reason we use prices, and in fact the reason we have, if you want to get all bloody philosophical about it, money in the first place, is to give us sort of this independent arbiter of value, right, so that we can work out, you know, what's worth more, a chocolate bar or a balloon, right, because they're very, very different goods, right? Prices let us compare different goods or different bads. So, thinking about our private cloud, what do you charge for it? What price do you set? Say we're at 1,000. All right, what price do we need to start thinking about charging? Well, we've got this public cloud as well, and that's going to charge us. And I've got lots of round numbers here. I mean, the actual numbers don't bloody matter a whole lot today. All right, you know, what am I going to charge here? Because I'm not trying to make money out of this. I'm just trying to drive some good incentives. You know, so it's really, am I trying to recover my costs? Maybe. So if I'm going to do sort of cost recovery, what I probably want to charge is the marginal cost. What is the cost to start the 1,001th machine? Who wants to have a stab? Nobody. Heavens, I've got a chocolate bar. This is an incentive, ladies and gentlemen. $100. How did you come up with $100? Wow. You can have that, Bryce, just for taking it on the chin and exposing yourself to the ridicule of a room full of people. So we've got fixed costs, right? I've got some machines, I've got some facilities, I've got some people. I'm totally going to enter that Microsoft competition to do something cool in the data center. And I've got some variable costs, right? Power, licenses, those might be variable. Who thinks those are variable costs? They nominally are variable costs. The problem is that when machines aren't doing stuff in your data center, how often do people usually turn them off? No. And licensing, who's heard of Windows Server Data Center licensing? Oh yeah, that stuff's awesome, right? So what is the marginal cost? It is 0 cents per hour. Shit. I'm back to where I bloody started. That's not going to work, right? Okay. Let's have another stab. Okay, so maybe we should factor our fixed costs across those 1,000 machines available, right? Just assume we're running at full capacity and we're good to go. Okay, and we might, you know, we could come up with a range of different numbers, and if we're too expensive, then everybody go use the public cloud and we'll have a whole lot of stuff sitting there doing absolutely nothing. And if we're too cheap, we're back to where we bloody well started. So, there's a bit of a problem. So then the question is, you know, does it make sense to price on an hourly basis? you know, for cost recovery and to drive incentives. Because certainly, I mean, it doesn't make sense for me to price it on an hourly basis, you know, in terms of my costs, because the costs are fixed. But what about the drive incentives? Feel free to say, yeah, drives incentives, man, yeah, go. Or no, that's a bad idea. Yes, you think, well done, who was that? Well done, I might have another chocolate bar, we'll see. I think I've got one more chocolate bar question shortly. So actually the biggest opportunity with the cloud in terms of the economics of the bloody thing, the complete no-brainer, is stuff that's hardly ever running. Right? It's absolutely fantastic. If you're running stuff on-prem and you want like a DR site, stand up a little like, you know, SQL server and log ship to it, and then and then back up the rest of your VMs over there, and if stuff goes down, wham bam, thank you, ma'am. I've got a really low-cost DR site. What does that look like? All right, so if we think about, you know, maybe 40 cents of compute time and 100 gigs of storage, if we're running 24/7, we're looking at $288 worth of compute a month and $6 worth of storage. If we're running for just 4 hours a month, you know, we really aren't spending a lot on compute. So we had a look around and we go, have we got any stuff that looks like this? And we kind of went, yeah, actually, we've got a whole lot of stuff that looks like that. We've got this big bunch of machines that we use for supporting our customers. So we have all these VMs that we sort of have hanging around ready to support customers. All right. It's fantastic if we can go get some really, really cheap storage and compute on demand. Right? Even if that compute actually might be a bit more expensive than what we could do ourselves. Because the stuff we do ourselves is we can only make that cheaper if we're working on a 24/7 basis. So, that sounds pretty good. So, you know, it probably does make sense to think about, you know, making sure that we leave those, you know, intraday incentives in place. The other thing is you've got to watch for externalities. So externalities are kind of costs and benefits that happen outside the scope of the transaction itself. Who can think of an interesting externality with Windows Azure that might drive incentives? The slide should give you a hint. Credit card points. Oh, hell yeah. Right? Hey, guess what? If I can go and stick this through on my credit card and expense payment each month, I'm going to get some serious points. So that's an externality, isn't it? Right? There are some externalities in terms of how easy or hard it is to use these various systems. Right? And so you've got to really watch for these externalities. You've got to make sure that they're not in the way influencing people's decisions. You know, people always talk about, you know, the cloud's super easy, it's self-service, you know. And that's a key benefit. You might need to neutralise that benefit. You might need to make it as hard to use the cloud as it is to use your on-prem stuff. Otherwise, you're going to have incentives that may get out of whack. And you may not make the appropriate use of your existing sunk cost capital resources and the cloud itself. You've got to get the incidents right. Otherwise, you've got to hit the right person with the stun gun. Right. Who do you want to hit with the stun gun? Yeah, CIO. Absolutely, you silly bugger. Why did you go and buy bloody 1,500 machines worth of bloody private cloud? No. Right, because the CIO is not going to go and turn stuff on and off. He's just going to go, shit, there's too much bloody running. Someone else go sort it out. You want the cost incidents to land on the person most able to change their behaviour. So the person responsible, if we're talking about machines used for projects, we want it to land on the person responsible for managing the resources on projects, where that cost really hits them and hurts them. I'm kind of been talking sadistically, but, you know, metaphorically, that's where you want to whack, right? Because eventually they'll go, oh, wow, I got a whole lot of crap running that I really don't need. I'm going to turn it off. So what might the answer look like? Right? So we sort of looked at them, and we're looking at doing sort of the following. So we're going to aim to try and normalise the costs between public and private cloud. You know, so Whichever one's more expensive at any point in time, we're going to work to, to effectively normalise those. And that way we can use substitution to basically balance our load between public and private cloud and always leave a little bit left over, right? Because if you think about the car parks, right, what is the right price for those car parks in San Francisco? Yeah, it's the lowest possible price that we can charge while still leaving, one or two parks free on every block all the time for someone who really needs a car park, right? Because that's what we have that street parking for. I really need a car park right now. There you go, you can get a car park right now. Right, so that's what we want, right? I really need a VM right now, and it's got to be housed in New Zealand. That's what we want to be able to support. Right? So we need to make sure that those who really need to be domiciled in New Zealand, because we have customers who say, hey, it can't be in the cloud, they need to pay a bit extra for that. Right? And then we need to make sure that those incentives hit the right place. And for us, that was really the people with the biggest opportunity to change behaviour. And for us, that's our support folks. Right? So that's... look at how can we use those incentives to drive the cost savings into their business unit to change from, stacking a whole lot of stuff up and running it all the time to, running it up in the cloud only when required. Thoughts? Anybody have thinking like this in their business at the moment? Crikey. A couple? What sort of car is that? Trabant, yeah. So the funny story about the Trabant, and I don't know if any of you read some of the New Zealand economics blogs, so I certainly won't claim complete credit for coming up with this right now, is that the story with the Trabant is that it was made in East Germany, and the guy from VW went to visit them and did a tiki tour of the factory, and then he worked out that, actually the raw materials going into the process are worth more than the cars coming out. And that's a bit of a problem. and we need to think about these things, right? So we can really measure in a whole lot more detail than we used to be able to, at a much finer grained level, what are the input costs into these applications that we built. So again, we built some big bloody spreadsheets. To try and come up with, what do we think in terms of the relative sort of price points between Azure Cloud and our on-prem stuff? And we're up, 1,500 machines is probably a reasonable sized, that's VMs, not physical machines, a reasonable sized, private cloud for a small organisation. So we reckon that as long as you're running 24 hours, 7 days a week, it's probably about half as expensive as Azure to run on-prem, as long as you are running 24/7. All right? And we reckon it's probably roughly an order of magnitude cheaper for storage and bandwidth in the cloud. So, would I go and build, go and buy a whole load more hardware, once I start rolling my existing stuff off lease? Probably not. The cloud march is inevitable. And we're going to be moving towards a model where the stuff that we hold on-prem is really focused on people who specifically have that requirement to be domiciled in New Zealand. Yes, that includes people. Yep. So this is fully factored, people, facilities, power, all that sort of stuff. Yep. And it is marching fast. It's a losing battle, right? And that's using quite high density blade servers. So you wouldn't be able to do that at small scale. It's not going to be like that for long because prices are changing. So this is another chocolate bar question. So there's something you can buy in Azure today, and it is 5% of the cost as when it originally launched. Who can tell me what that thing is? Tell me more. Tell me more. It's not. It's, tell me more about storage. IOPS. Who said IOPS first? There we go. Can you pass this chocolate bar so carefully back to that gentleman there? It's storage transactions. Yeah, exactly. There's two, so share it with your mate. It's one of those double bars, right? Yeah, it's basically, it's those storage transactions. I used to have this little party trick right back in the early days of Azure that I used to wheel around Redmond and go see various team members and say, session state, SQL Azure, as it then was called, or Windows Azure Table Storage, which one's better? Everyone said Azure Table Storage. Then I get out my spreadsheet and say, you are on crack. All right? It's actually three times the price. And they go, that can't be right. And then I go, look at my spreadsheet. All right? And what was killing it was those storage transactions, 1 cent for every 10,000 storage transactions. So you've got to look at exactly how some of these things are made up. And in fact, that, you know, that's that. Those two lines at the bottom are basically what it used to be. And these two are worth that 130 and 2600. That's that 5% of what it used to be. So it's gone from 1 cent for 10,000 to half a cent per 100,000. So when you buy these various things, you're either going to be buying some sort of reserved capacity that's kind of use it or lose it, right? Or you're going to be paying for the stuff that you use, right? And so Azure Tables is a great example of pay-as-you-go for both storage and throughput. Right? I've not got any reserve capacity, and I pay for all of my throughput. Now, that's great because it means that, you know, I don't have to do any thinking about it. And also, it doesn't cost me any more to be steady state, right, versus massively peaky. Right? It doesn't cost me any more for the same number of transactions. Whereas these other services, you know, often I'm buying like a bucket of storage and a bucket of throughput. And I've got to account for what I want the throughput peaks to be. And there, if I'm really peaky, right, the same number of sort of total transactions is going to cost me a whole lot more. But if I'm steady state, right, as you can see, it's quite a bit cheaper, right, to be buying on a reserve capacity basis. And this is often the sort of thinking that you need to put into your apps as you say, you know, how am I going to architect this app? What services am I going to use? Okay, well, I need to think about, you know, what it'll look like in terms of, you know, burstability. Right. And there are a few sort of tricks that can help in terms of making it, taking the edge off some of those I have to buy the bucket of capacity thing. So I reckon it was a mispricing, right? And you know, it didn't drop by 95%, right? For any reason other than we kind of sort of mispriced it. But of course, Amazon was the same cost, right? So they just watched Amazon and said, okay, we're going to be the same as Amazon. And then sort of everybody's kind of going, yeah, that's actually wrong. And it's really only, that mispricing has really only just been unrolled, right? So you always want to be looking for opportunities to take advantage of mispricing. Who's heard the story about the Chicago Economist and the $20 bill? All right, so Chicago Economist walking down the street and sees a 20, you know, one of his mates sees a $20 bill on the ground and says, hey, there's a $20 bill, you should go pick it up. And he says, no, it's not there. All right, because the Chicago Economist believes that markets are perfectly efficient and if there was a $20 bill on the ground, someone would have picked it up already. That's just not the case, right? Where there are inefficiencies in these pricing systems, you've actually got quite a lot of time to take advantage of them. Right? Because when, you know, even though there's really strong competition, it's not a perfect market. These aren't continually dynamic prices. So you can often take advantage of these things. And if you're a big user, a big spender, you might do pretty well out of taking advantage of these things. You know, you might get a few years' run of some pretty good prices. So you should always be on the lookout for stuff where you go, actually, I think that's probably cheaper than it should be, and I'm going to architect my application to the cost model. I offend so many people when I say you should architect your application to the cost model. I say, what if it changes? Well, it's going to change eventually, but, hey, you get lots of, like, run-out time, lots of warning, The only sharp edge is if you're trying to take advantage of something undocumented. All right? You know, Windows Azure SQL database, sort of back in the good old days, $5 database, you get huge amount of throughput out of that. Right? Because it was basically unthrottled throughput. The throughput on the small database was potentially the same as the throughput on the really big database. That was kind of undocumented, and over time that kind of wound down. So you've got to be a little bit careful, but you should absolutely think about how can I architect my application to the cost model. Right? Because that's, you're either going to be taking advantage of, you know, what you think is a mispricing, or the provider is using cost to do a good job of signaling to you what is the most efficient way to build your application. So buying these things in these buckets and dealing with these peaks and troughs can be a bit of a pain in the neck. So I'm a fan of architecting your application like a call center. When you call a call center these days, anybody had like an engaged tone from a call center in the past year? One or two, right? So they do a pretty good job of failing gracefully, right? So even if you're calling a really busy call center, you don't get a really bad experience. Whereas as IT people, we're really bad at building systems that are brittle, right? They're either working or they just completely shat themselves, and you might as well go home and just hang out until they start again. Right? We build these really brittle systems. Right? So I think it's important to think about, you know, what are some of these concepts that they use in a call center? And we spoke about this already. So obviously we use price for rationing. How else do we ration? Queuing, right? And queuing is basically a cost trade-off, right? Because the only reason that people have to queue at the call center is because we haven't got enough call center reps. Right? And we could have enough call center reps, but if we got enough call center reps for the really busy times, what would those call center reps be doing most of the time? Minesweeper, or Minecraft now, probably. Right? Depends on who buys it and puts it in the operating system. People saw that story today. Anyone big on Minecraft? Oh, that's good. Kids are. Right? It's dealing with those peaks and troughs. So what do? Well, we put people in a queue, and then we feed the people out of the queue. And what's the trade-off we're making? Well, we're not spending as much money, hiring a whole lot of people for the peaks, and occasionally our customers have to wait a little while, but actually that's okay. Right. And when we're broken, right, when stuff's gone wrong and people are hammering the call centre, yeah, we can sort of, you know, hide it under the rug a little bit. We need to be better at doing that in our IT systems. We need to be better at, you know, thinking about where can I put some sort of buffer into my application so that I can take the edge off my peaks and troughs. Because if I can take the edge off my peaks and troughs, I can take down the amount of reserve capacity I have to buy. And reserve capacity, that's the really expensive stuff. And the nice side effect is that if something goes wrong somewhere in my system, actually, you know, there's a good chance that I can not fail hard, but fail in a sort of a more graceful, you know, slightly degraded mode. So the other thing you do in a call center is you protect your expensive assets. So when you call the help desk, right, you don't usually get to talk to the Tier 3 engineer straight away. Why? Because there aren't many of them. They're very expensive. So what do? You get to talk to the tier one guy or girl, right? And, you know, there's lots of those, right? And we're basically using those to protect the more expensive resources. And we have that sort of scenario in our applications, right? So who can think of sort of really expensive resources in these applications, thinking back to that slide? SQL servers, right? They're expensive. They're really hard. You know, they're expensive, but B, they're really hard to scale if we think about how we scale in cloud land. Why? Because they're transactional, and distributed transactions are really hard to scale because you've got to have distributed locks. And as soon as you've got locks, scaling is, yeah. Right? So what do? We protect our expensive assets. Right? We put things like caches in front of them. Right? Some other interesting expensive asset stories. Got like an awesome on-premise ERP system. And you think, I'm gonna do some customer self-service, and I'm gonna use the cloud because they're like an infinite scale. I can scale up and I can scale down. So I'm gonna build this in the cloud, and hey, my ERP's got web services, so that's awesome because I know web services and I can do SOAP and XML or JSON if you're that way inclined. So I'm gonna get my app in the cloud and connect it to my ERP system, and then, wow, this is really awesome, customers love it. I'm gonna scale up. This is really awesome. Wow, we had a disaster, I'm gonna really scale up. What have I just built? A distributed denial of a service attack, right? I mean, literally, I've just DDoSed my on-prem system, right? My core line of business system, right? Myself, by scaling up in the cloud. So we need to think, you know, how are we protecting those expensive resources? You know, caches, queues, and we're not talking even long lifetime caches. If you've got a really high throughput database workload that's reads, right? You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 second cache is going to suck a huge amount of load off that really expensive hard to scale part, and you can go stick it in a really cheap to scale thing. Right. Protecting those expensive assets. And we don't waste our precious resources, right? So, you know, you don't find many of the senior folks in call centers sitting around doing nothing. When we go and buy those buckets of resource, right? You know, we go and buy, say, an Azure cloud service machine or something like that. You know, we're buying a bucket of RAM, we're buying a bucket of CPU, we're buying a bucket of storage, right? Because it's got some on-instance storage. Make sure you're using all of it. If you've got a CPU-intensive workload and you're not using the RAM, come up with a way that you can use that RAM, right? What can I do with the RAM to maybe help me not have to jump off box all the time? Right? You know, again, caching, good idea. Right? If you've got spare RAM in your front-end roles of your cloud apps, right, stick a cache on there. Stick a, you know, in-role cache on there. Right? Use all of those resources. Otherwise, you're just basically tinkling money down the drain. Anybody good at that? Right? Everybody got, like, does that make sense? Yeah, because you got to buy the bundle of goods. I mean, what would be really nice is to unbundle the whole lot. I mean, that's one nice thing we can do in our private cloud is we unbundle CPU and RAM. All right, and you get a little bit of that in Azure, so you've got the high RAM instances and so forth. But when stuff's bundled, right, when you get the free dessert, you know, you don't leave that sitting on the table. Cool. Complex and simple pricing. So a lot of people, you know, they look at some of these cloud services and they go, wow, that pricing model is so complex, I can't understand it. And it's completely unpredictable, and that means, you know, I'm really, really worried. Whereas I look at a complex pricing model and I go, sweet, I've got lots of levers. All right? You know, so I can use, you know, those levers to drive exactly how I do my application. A really great example is the pricing model for Windows Azure Media Services. Right. So, and it's common to see these richer pricing models, more sophisticated, more nuanced pricing models, sort of the higher you climb up the stack, as you get these sort of more sophisticated high-level services, rather than just buying commoditized stuff. Right, you're often starting to see sort of more nuanced pricing models. Right, so that lets you do things like, you know, I can not reserve capacity and wait in the queue for my encoding, or I can reserve capacity and not wait in the queue, but whatever I do, I'm actually going to pay for the processing that I do, and I can do the same thing streaming out. Right, and then when it comes to actually playing these files, I'm going to pay on a sort of a per playback license basis for the encrypted files and so forth. And so I can get there and I can go, actually, you know, if I look at my model, you know, if I want to get content into the hands of consumers really, really quickly, I've got a reserve capacity, so maybe I won't do that. But obviously I do need to encrypt my content, and, you know, it's costing me N cents per play to do the encrypted content. So let me look at how much I'm getting paid for each play. You know, what's my margin there? Okay, that looks pretty good, right? So, you know, because it, you'll end up building a financial model where you go, okay, what's my revenue per customer? And as much as possible, you want to try and relate that back to the costs of actually running this thing. And it's now possible to really start doing that, right? So you can literally say, if I've got really fine-grained control of the costs, right, there's actually a pretty good chance that I can match up my cost to operate against my revenue and have a pretty strong view of actually what is my margin on my cost of goods for each of my customers. And then we come back to CapEx and OpEx again. Because a lot of you are going, shit, this stuff's too bloody clever by half, right? And in many cases it is. You can be a really clever cat and really sort of knuckle down and work out how the hell do I game this system and how do I really optimise the pricing model and so forth and go and do a whole lot of dev efforts to make that happen. But if you're not at sufficient scale, it just doesn't make sense, right? And so, the thing that's going to happen moving forward is that we're going to end up in a situation where you're really looking at trading CapEx for OpEx primarily by looking at how much do I invest in dev effort, basically, how hard do I squeeze the lemon in terms of getting these savings. Is anybody fine by doing that at the moment? Just making the call and saying, actually, it's cheaper just to pay for it. Because the nice thing about a lot of these cloud services is a lot of them are really already built. And you go and say, okay, I'm going to go buy Azure Media Services. And it's quite expensive. And I could probably do it cheaper myself. But it would take, some serious effort to actually get myself into a position to be able to do it myself. Right? So I'm prepared to pay that higher OpEx. It's not so much the capitalization of the hardware and things, it's the capitalization of the build effort on those higher level services that you're taking advantage of. And I think you're going to start to see more of that. You're going to start to see, you will continue to see a really hard downward march for those commoditized services where there's basically multi-vendor competition and everybody's just eating each other, right? Amazon, Google, Microsoft. If you want CPU time and RAM and storage, it's just a march to the bottom. Right? And there's no way we can compete, right, here in New Zealand because our interest rates are 5% and their interest rates are like 1.5%. We're gonna get killed, right? So that stuff's gonna keep going that way, and then the stuff that's not gonna move so fast, right, are those higher level services, the differentiated services, right? Where it's less about cost plus pricing, more about really charging for the sort of value you get. The one challenge you have with those pricing models that endeavour to charge for the value that the customer gets is it's very hard for them to work well across the full continuum of scale. Because down at the small scale end, right, you've got the customer who's adopting, say, Windows Azure Media Services because it's really quick in terms of time to market, right? I can get to market really quick, it's already there for me. Don't have to build anything, great. That's huge value to me, right? So I'm probably happy to pay quite a high per unit cost to use that because actually I'm not doing that many units. And to go and do it myself is really hard. At the other end of the scale spectrum, a really big customer, right, I could go and do it myself. And if I'm and the reason I would want to use the cloud is because I want the economies of scale. I want some of that flow down of economies of scale. Right, and the problem with those higher level, more expensive pricing models is that often they're not reflecting those economies of scale. Is that right? Yeah, so often I could do it cheaper myself. And I think there's one of the challenges for the various cloud providers is going to be coming up with mechanisms to deliver pricing that works at both ends of the scale continuum, right? That extracts lots of value out of customers who are using your service because of the rapid time to market, but doesn't lose the custom of the really large scale customers because it's not able to deliver them those economies of scale benefits. And so I've come up about 10 minutes short, so that's good. So we can have some Q&A, AMA, ask me anything. Up the back. Yeah. So the question was, you know, if you're doing it over 5 years, you've also, obviously you've got to do the, you effectively reboot the capital at the end of 5 years and do it again. And the thing a lot of, and there was a really good point about the pushing it in, you know, so a lot of people forget or omit the racking and stacking cost for these things, right? A lot of people, when they look at, you know, cloud migrations, they kind of potentially, you know, forget to think about just how expensive, you know, the actual move is. It's actually one of the challenges of moving brownfield stuff to the cloud, is that if it's running 24/7, right, we know, running 24/7, we know, you know, it's probably a coin toss as to whether it's cheaper, but there's a decent chunk of cost to actually make that move. You know, so for brownfield stuff, it is actually all about going and fishing around the organisation, going, okay, what are my bursty workloads? What stuff that I can have turned off? All right, because that's the really high value stuff to move sooner rather than later. Other questions? Yep, so where do you factor refurb and maintenance? So when we did our calculations, we did factor labour costs and sort of ongoing licence costs for sort of upgrade and maintenance. The hardware cost is all factored on lease-based pricing, so let's just give it back at the end of the lease period, which is probably not the most efficient. You could probably do it cheaper if your weighted average cost of capital was lower than ours. Yes. Well, your lease effectively factors in depreciation. You know, and if it's a lease, I expense it. So you know, it's at the end of the day, everything in terms of hitting the P&L statement, everything hits the P&L statement at some point in time. It's all right, it is all just timing, right? And you know, cost of capital is really the thing that drives, you know, how enthusiastic you are around sort of changing that timing. You know, so whether you lease an expense or whether you capitalize and depreciate, at some point everything hits the P&L. You know, so yeah. Does that sort of help to answer that question? No? Oh yeah, I mean, absolutely. So, you, and that is the problem with that is the problem. If you are, you know. From your capital purchase. It comes down to that very first slide, right? It comes down to having an accurate cost of capital calculation. And for a lot of organizations they don't yet have the maturity in terms of actually knowing, you know, what is their cost of capital. I'll go, you know, my cost of capital is, you know, 6 or 7% because that's my bank borrowing rate. No, that's absolutely not your cost of capital. Your cost of capital is probably going to be significantly higher than that, depending on how risky your business is, because you've got a whole lot of equity that you've got to give a return on. So, yeah, you do need to have a... Unfortunately, I probably should have spent a bit more time on that crazy joke slide, but you know, it's understanding that cost of capital is not just the interest rate, right? You know, it's actually accounting for the fact that I need to give a return on equity, and if it's a risky business, I've got to give a pretty high return on equity, right? You know, and that should help you make sensible, you know, capital investment decisions. Yeah, you know, but, yeah, exactly. The whole, you know, the losing value as soon as it's racked and stacked. But also you have the other end of the spectrum. You know, you've got to think about situations where you can sweat the asset for much longer than its book life, right? And again, you know, that's... Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There was a question here. I don't think... Most New Zealand businesses aren't super mature in terms of the way that they do sort of project financing calculations. I mean, we do quite a lot of big projects at Intergen, and I don't see a huge amount of maturity in terms of looking at exactly how, you know... We don't have a whole lot of project financing maturity. The reason I think we don't have a whole lot of project financing maturity is we don't have a whole lot of big projects, you know, certainly in the IT sector. You know, we don't have that many really big projects where you see the sort of, you know, the project financing maturity that you'd see in, like, you know, some of the big infrastructural stuff. Would anybody disagree with that? Oh, you know, tens of millions. You know, tens of millions. All good, team. I am going to bug out to the Intergen booth in the exhibition area. It's the yellow one, surprise, surprise. Very soon. I'd love to see some of you. Thank you for coming along. Please do your evals.